Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
That fight ground on for exactly as long as it seemed to need to go. And, you know, everybody did a fairly reasonable amount of damage each turn until... That's not the stuff people remember. They like to remember the crazy, like, you know, the roles that kind of just shift things dramatically.
This interview is over a year old. For some unknown reason, Jason's audio came in very distorted on the files themselves, and I've done my best to clean it up, and I can tell you the insights we get from Jason made all this work worth it. I loved hearing how his various experiences and endeavors really led up and helped him to become one of the most respected creators in the business. I finally learned exactly what someone does when they're in charge of an RPG line, of which Jason leads too. His knowledge of the history of the hobby is stunning, especially knowing he was often in the room when it happened. And I apologize to Jason for taking this long to release what is really a great conversation. It took a year for my audio ninja skills to level up to meet the needs of this episode. So sit back, relax, and enjoy a great conversation with Jason.
I'm Allison Arth. And when I'm not busy disagreeing with Craig Shipman about his feelings on Billy Joel's songwriting capabilities, I'm listening to Tabletop Talk.
Howdy, friends. Craig here. Today, we talk to the writer, designer, and world builder for tabletop and digital games, Jason Dural. He has worked on books for Conan 2D20, Dune 2D20, various Cthulhu Mythos games, and many, many others. He's the creative director for RuneQuest and Basic Roleplaying with Chaosium. So Jason, welcome to the third floor.
Hey, Craig, thanks for having me.
So I hate to do this to you, but I always end up asking probably the number one most common question that you've answered a million times, which is there was a day where you knew nothing about rolling dice, creating people on a sheet of paper and then playing pretend. And then you found tabletop gaming. So I'd be real curious, Jason, if we can go back to the moment you were first exposed to it.
Wow. That would be a dizzying trip through the mists of time. My mother bought me a copy of Dungeons and Dragons. I think it was still in the first edition era, but it was not the first printing.
Right.
And it was one of those. It was from the Sears catalog. We were picking out Christmas gifts. And, you know, my mom said, pick stuff that you would like. And so I picked Dungeons and Dragons. And I said, this more than anything. I knew nothing about it other than it looked really cool.
Yeah.
You know, it had a wizard and a warrior fighting a crazy dragon on top of a pile of treasure. And I was a big Lord of the Rings fan. And, you know, I was already reading fantasy and Conan at age like 9 or 10. So as soon as that came out, I was just hooked. My mom bought it for me. I tried a disastrous game with my family, which was not at all well received. And then I sort of put it away. And then a year later, we were, we'd moved to another city. I was hanging out with a friend and I looked across the street and a bunch of kids were crouched on the sort of rock garden, a landscaped garden in front of their house. And they had all these books and papers and they were like looking for something. And I went over and asked what they were doing. And they said, oh, we're playing a game. And I looked and they had these tiny little lead miniatures. And they were using their landscaping and rock garden as their exterior dungeon area. And I thought, can I play? And then that was, I think that was like 1978, 1979. And I've been, except for brief periods where I was,
you know, not surrounded by gamers, I've been gaming ever since.
So preteen, you discover Dungeons and Dragons. It sounds like, you know, the hooks, once the hooks got set, they got set pretty good. What's after that? Did you stay with Dungeons and Dragons for a long time, or when did you get exposed to something more than D&D?
Actually, I stayed with Dungeons and Dragons for almost no time at all. It was very rapidly that I just realized that D&D really wasn't scratching the itch for me. And my friends and I, we purchased like pretty much everything that was out. Somebody would buy it and we would play it. We were playing Boot Hill. We were playing Gamma World. We played Top Secret. We were playing. And then we hit the Chaosium game. And that was really it. A friend of mine, she was really into H.P. Lovecraft, and so I picked up Call of Cthulhu because I thought she might like that, and then I immediately got hooked into Stormbringer, and since I was a huge Elric fan, that just set me off playing that, and then it was literally like as the Chaosium games came out, we picked them up one after another, RuneQuest, ElfQuest, Worlds of Wonder, Superworld, all of those, Pendragon, and there were some other games that we played. What was the game called? Yuzgarth. That, for some reason, stuck. We played it for a couple of years. Dragon Quest. Little bit of Marvel, superheroes, Cyworld, and some of the fantasy Fantasy Games Unlimited games, like Bushido, and I can't remember the other that we played. We didn't play Chivalry and Sorcery, interestingly enough, but Aftermath. So it was I think we dabbled with space opera. So it was just pretty much almost anything to come down the path. I think we played some Twilight 2000 and, you know, games as they came out, Chill, Time Master.
That's one of my favorites,
Chill. Ghostbusters. I mean, great, it was, these were the heydays of gaming where we could play like three or four nights a week. And, you know, we would literally have these epic binge game sessions in high school, you know, for like the weekend where we'd play for like 12 hours. Of course, my friends, their mom would come. It was two brothers, and we'd play at their place, and their mom kept coming in. She's like, "Don't you want to go outside? It's nice." And we're like, "No, we're huddled around a card table in their bedroom. They had bunk beds next to us, and we were all playing with little cracks of light coming in from the outside world." But yes,
So it's incredible to me, Jason, just the huge menu that you sampled from during all of that time. And, you know, obviously when you're growing up and you're in high school and into college and continuing on and trying all these games, you don't have quite an awareness of where you were headed, right? And where you would become as an adult. But now where you are and you look back at those times, are there any of those games in particular that you look back to and say, "I think part of why I approach my work now is because I played X"?
Yes, that would be, honestly, it would probably be Stormbringer more than any other, because it was such a loose, wild game, and it really emphasized that game balance is not a requirement for fun play. And I think that the aspect of this sort of chaotic aspect of the game, no pun intended, but the fact that you could just have wildly different experiences, and it really opened my eyes to tinkering with games. Yeah. I mean, like, for example, I would have, at that time, I would have had very little idea how to, you know, tinker with D&D or Dragon Quest or Universe or any of these really sort of sophisticated, carefully balanced games, whereas Stormbringer just always felt like it was just wide open for creative collaboration and sort of coming up with my own content. And it was very easy to subtract the system from the setting and do all sorts of other things with Stormbringer. Like before,
before Hawkmoon came out, I had already figured out how to role play in Hawkmoon's world and the Tragic Millennium, and in both Stormbringer and Dragon Quest, of all things. So, nice. Yeah, and I think that that was the big the emphasis. And then the next thing would be Pendragon. That would be the second most influential game for me, and that it really taught me how to make mechanics that can mirror personality conflicts and emphasize that your character is more than just their sheer destructive power.
I am amazed, Jason, how often Pendragon is brought up by other designers that I talk to. It may be the most common one, and it is the one that I've heard from more than few people that they consider it to this day the only perfect game ever made as far as role playing. Do you have a sense of why that is?
I think that it does not try to do everything. It tries to do one thing and it does it impeccably well.
Yeah.
And it just says we are going to model Arthurian knightly behavior in this setting, and that's it. I mean, it nails it on every front. I mean, it's economical. There's no it's not a bloated game. It's not got pages and pages of treasure tables and you know, arcane formulas for falling damage and whatnot, right. Because it's just absolutely it's clean and elegant in a way. And I think that is, it appeals to designers because, yeah. You know, most of them, when they look at Pendragon and like, if you know, you ask like, what would you change? A lot of people are just like, I wouldn't. And for game designers to be saying that is pretty significant. I mean, I might say, well, you know, maybe the ranged combat is not quite satisfying, but I'm like, ranged combat was not really the thing that knights were all about. And so, right. You know, it would be like saying that there's no, you know, crafting system, or you know, it's like, well, that's not what knights do. They don't try to build forges and, you know, try to come up with blacksmith shops and make money selling arms and armor to other knights.
I felt like the spelunking rules were missing, yes, from the,
yes,
book, right?
Yes, the surveying rules, and the aerial combat is really right. Not covered very well. But so otherwise, sounds, yeah,
oh,
it's,
please, yeah,
it's just, like I say, it's just brilliant in its elegance. And I think that Greg Stafford, he nailed it there. And I mean, I don't know if I would say it's the perfect game, but it's certainly as close to one as there could be.
That's really, really cool. So if I'm hearing this correctly, Jason, it sounds like in some ways Stormbringer was kind of the first time where you got the inspiration and the permission to start tinkering, right? To start doing more than just homebrewing campaigns, but actually start, you know, creating.
Yeah.
Does that sound accurate?
That was, I mean, I was immediately trying to figure out new character classes and new types of demons and new sorts of figuring out how to cobble together magic items and whatnot. And then I just yoinked the system out of it. And I think I adapted it to the Hyborian Age. I think I ran a Dark Age, Iron Age, or it was Iron Age, not Dark Age, something loosely based off the Cormac MacArt and Bard books with the characters were sort of Vikings and Celts running around. Nice. in the English Isles and whatnot. So yeah, I felt that the setting was just really both the more cocky and craziness, but then you could just zip over to a parallel universe or to another of the million spheres and run a completely different game using the same engine. And I thought that was pretty cool. You know, instantly I was trying to figure out how to put Jerry Cornelius in my Stormbringer games and, you know, figuring out rules for vibra guns and needle pistols and whatnot. And
that's awesome.
I was like, oh, it's actually quite easy and it works.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of people listening, including myself, you know, we've meddled with stuff, we've added stuff here and there. But we ended up not becoming professionals, quote unquote, which I know is not some magical term, but I'd be curious, Jason, looking back on it, when do you see that transition, whether it be I fell into it, or I consciously made a choice where you were going to share with more than just your table, that you were going to create for a much wider audience.
It was Amber Diceless Role Playing. I was living in Japan at the time, and I had a subscription to Dragon Magazine. I am a huge fan of Zelazny. I considered him to be one of the towering giants in fantasy and science fiction. And the Chronicles of Amber were among my favorite novels. And one day I saw a little ad in Dragon Magazine for the Amber Diceless Role Playing, and I thought, that sounds really cool. So I sent a check to the United States, and Eric Wujcik mailed me a copy, and then he called shortly after to see that the package got to me, because he was just filling orders himself. And then he also was like, I just wanted to know who in Japan was, you know, ordering a copy of Amber. And I said, yeah, and if you ever, I said, I just got it. I haven't read it, but I'm going to read it. I'm taking a tour through Europe very soon, so I'm going to take it with me and read it. And I came back from that, and I immediately sent this gushing fan letter to Eric and said, if you are ever taking submissions for this game, I would love to write something for you. And he said, well, what would you like to write? And I pitched him a few things, and he said, of them, half of one of them was something he would like me to write. And so I was going to do a flip book of Rebma and Tirna Nogth. And if you know anything about the Amber setting, Amber is this eternal city in the middle of the universe of infinite worlds. And there's a reflection of Amber in the sky above that only appears at moonlight, and that's Tirna Nogth. And then there's a reflection of Amber in the water below in the sort of sea next to the castle. And that's called Rebma, which is just Amber spelled backwards, kind of a silly joke on Zelazny's part. And I said I wanted to do a book called As Above, So Below that would be both Tirna Nogth and Rebma. And Wujcik said, I'm writing the Tirna Nogth book, but why don't you write Rebma? And so that was my trial by fire to writing an RPG supplement, like immediately jump into the writing a 56 page book. And it was a little weird. It was a incredibly rough experience, and the book still has never been published because we could do an hour just talking about the history of the Amber game. But anyway, that really opened my eyes. And when I got back to the United States, I contacted a bunch of different other publishers. I was excited, and I started doing some little freelance bits for Chaosium, for White Wolf with their Infobia magazine. And I hit the fanzines hard and just peppered them with articles for whatever game appealed to me at the time. And it's a lot of games that most people have never heard of, you know, like Legendary Lives or Lost Souls or anyway, these kind of weird things. I'd write, like, I think I wrote some archetypes for Cult, and just various things like this appeared throughout a lot of different magazines. And then it just went from there. And at one point, I remember I was sort of one of those people that always shows up at the booth and chats with the developers. And I ended up chatting with the people at Chaosium, and they pitched, like I said, hey, I'd love to work for you and write something. And so they said, well, we're doing a D20 version of Elric called Dragon Lords of Melniboné. You want to write an adventure for it? And I said, sure. And so that was my first real substantial credit, other than work on Shadow Knight for Amber Diceless and a few other projects like that. So that was the first thing I wrote from soup to nuts that got published with that was exclusively my work.
So when you create or write, Jason, for a game, right? Like, so, you know, you talk to people and they say, well, I wrote for this. And in many ways, it can mean lots of different things, right?
Yes.
And, you know, looking at the, I don't know what the right word is, but the pillars of the hobby or whatever, you've got, you know, the storytelling, the setting, the scenarios, the mechanics. And I'd be curious, Jason, do you spread yourself evenly among all of those aspects and to take a holistic view of this? Are you drawn more to one than the other?
Well, as a line editor, I don't have the luxury of choice. It feels like, for the games I'm working on, I do a lot of actual design, or rather the games I'm managing, I do system design, tweaking systems or coming up with systems, coming up with mechanics, trying to balance things. And then for games I am just freelancing for or just contributing for, those are usually just exclusively content.
Got it.
You know, it's rare that I jump in and say, you know, somebody's doing a new IP and they say, oh, but we need somebody to come up with the magic system. And I've done that, but it's pretty rare.
Got it. So guys, the Insider Insight series is my opportunity to sit down with designers, developers, artists, writers, and creators and learn how they approach their work. I try to understand their process, inspiration, and the methods for crafting their creations. And that's what we're going to do with Jason today. So we're going to take a quick break and we're going to actually take a short pause because Jason didn't just create games for the tabletop. He also created some digital works. So I want to find out what that's all about. We'll be right back.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
You like science fiction, right? You love playing games, maybe even role-playing games. But what if you can't get your friends together for a game night? If you love games like Mothership or Orbital Blues, check out Dead Belt, a card-based space western solo strategy RPG about skillful and desperate scavengers picking over the remains of junked starships in hopes of a juicy payday. In it, you deal with lurking dangers, push your luck, and walk away with enough cred to keep on flying. Of course, you might get eaten by lurking aliens, or run afoul of rival scavengers, or face the murderous ghosts of long-dead spacers. No one said life in the Dead Belt was going to be easy. For more information on this and all of Sean and Abby Drake's games, swing over to acoupleofdrakes.com. The link's in the show notes.
So as listeners know, you know, I'm drawn to guests for various reasons. I reach out to them. Jason has been very generous about making time to talk to us. But what that also does is causes me to dig a lot deeper, right? So I try to put together and do some research to get ready. And Jason, you're not the first tabletop creator that I've talked to that has digital work on their resume. So I'd be curious, when did you first get drawn in to creating in that realm?
I was living in Seattle around 2000. I had left Japan and moved to Seattle, where I was working in desktop publishing for the medical publishing industry. It's editing and doing desktop publishing and web development for all of these gigantic medical manuals. And there, I was feeling a lot of dissatisfaction with the job. You know, it was really, you know, I was basically editing and responsible for publishing 7,000 page medical textbooks a year. And so it was an insane amount of work. And my brain was just crowded with all of this detail about, hospitalization procedures and case management and all of this pharmaceuticals.
And it was really nothing that I enjoyed. I mean, yeah. I loved the people I worked with. They were great, wonderful work environment. But I really just, the actual work itself, I'm not inclined towards medicine as a career. And so I definitely felt a little out of place. At the same time, I was in web development with the same company. And that was also where things were starting to get really technical. And this was back in the days of Go Live and all this like WYSIWYG web page development was a new thing.
Right.
You know? So and I wasn't super excited about it. And then out of the blue, some friends that I had met at an AmberCon, Amber Diceless role-playing yeah. convention, contacted me and said, hey, do you have any interest in moving to Austin, Texas to work on a computer game, an MMO? And I said, why, I have a lot of interest in doing that exact thing. That sounds really cool. I never considered it as a job hop, but it sounded really great. And so they said, well, we'll put you together a package and we'll make you an offer. And I said, well, if the offer is anything in this range, I'll take it. And so they said, okay, great. And then they were having some funding issues with their publisher. So there was a little bit of a delay. And in the meantime, I started having some, you know, my spider sense wet up at the web company. And I started going, I don't think this is going to last very long, because I was watching the web.com collapse in downtown yeah. Seattle, of all these places that had opened up giant and then were just closing and collapsing. And many of my friends were web devs who are just suddenly, you know, going from these like six-figure salaries to suddenly unemployed. And I was Ugh. Thinking, oh, this is not great. And then one day they summoned my department in at the medical publishing company and said, oh, well, I'm afraid we're going to have to let you go. And I was chuckling, and they said, oh, well, you seem to be taking it really well. And I said, yeah, I just got an offer letter this morning for a job in Austin making computer games. So thank you for the severance check. And
thanks for beating me by a day.
Yeah, basically. And so, you know, I had already even emptied my desk to the point where it was a little straight. I knew everything was, you know, every day I was just taking a little bit away. And then some friends were even sort of wondering why my desk had become so stark. And then, you know, a month later, I was living in Texas working in computer games with what was the last of the garage MMOs, a game called Shadowbane. And that was just a learning experience. It was, the game was still in, I'd say in the late early development, where they had a playable demo, but most of the work needed to be done. And I was the lead world builder for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to learn the world building tools, and in some cases actually help develop the world building tools with the programmers. And it was also a case of just, you sort of asked a question about a system, and that made you the master of that. You know, I was like, what's our plan for sound? And they said, good question. Why don't you figure that out for us? And you know, the people I met in that job, I mean, oddly enough, it was Amber Diceless that probably was the most influential force in my entire life. And that many of the people I met through that game and Amber Khan have been lifelong friends and are people that I'm still in touch with. And so, you know, and that's been like almost 30 years. So, yeah, and that's how I ended up as a computer game dev.
So what's interesting to me about that, Jason, is, I mean, you walk into Austin, Texas with a backpack of experience playing and creating for tabletop games. And now you're in a different medium, but obviously, you know, MMOs came from the tabletop, right? We're inspired by tabletop and we're trying to replicate that. How useful did you find what you had done before and what you had experienced and been exposed to before to be, and how much of it didn't matter because this was something new?
Everything turned out to be relevant. My major in college was English, and a focus on I sort of did the double thing where I studied both film communications and journalism.
Yeah.
And so mostly creative writing. And so I was both trying to figure out how to tell stories. And then over on the film studies side, I was learning about how to tell stories visually.
Mm-hmm.
And then through gaming, you know, it was all about coming up with exciting and interesting experiences.
I had lived in Japan, as I mentioned, for 6 years teaching at a university. And so I had this experience of communicating with people from another culture, you know, with this gulf of, you know, you have this filter of trying to get through to them and understand them. And then because the university was only open for 7 months a year, but I was paid a yearly salary, I had two and a half month vacations a year, basically, yeah. And I traveled. And so I got to see some China, Southeast Asia, wow. Russia, Europe, extensively in America. So I think that being just a small town, rural Oregonian growing up in this, just being sort of massively exposed to the world in this incredibly short period of time, and having a sense of wanderlust gave me a lot of sort of the aptitude for trying to figure out how to make games for people. And then, you know, I'd been into gaming and that translated really well into building environments in MMOs.
Yeah.
You know, and being able to pull out, like, I walked in this castle before, try to do something like this. And then the other thing was the web development and editing was also phenomenally useful because, you know, in computer game development, you're dealing with very technical issues. You're dealing with, you know, you're dealing with spreadsheets, you're dealing with access databases, and all of this was completely just like par for the course. It was exactly the combination of creative and technical. I managed just to fit right in. I mean, I leaned harder towards the creative aspects than the technical, but in the early days, it was a very easy transition.
When do you transition back then? So, or have you? I mean, are you still involved creating digital games, or have you pretty much transitioned just back to tabletop?
I'm right now just working in tabletop, and I'm immensely happy doing that.
Yeah.
I worked almost exclusively in MMOs, and with some smaller like phone games and mobile games when I was in Austin. But over the years, my primary focus was MMOs. Now, I moved to Germany to Berlin here where I live as with a computer game company. And then, all throughout that time I was freelancing and doing, stuff, not because I needed the money, but just because it was fun. And, so I really, worked on all of these different products for many, many, many different companies. I did play testing. I did proofreading. I did, some editing, I did, you know, content writing, all of the above. And I just kept my toe in that water. And then when I ended up in Berlin, I had already done the big gold basic role-playing book and a number of other projects. And so ironically, it happened that I had just finished doing a big thing with Modiphius for Octon Cthulhu. I was sort of already line managing Conan at that time. And I was talking with Chaosium, and then very quickly the new owners of Chaosium sort of said, hey, do you have any interest in working with us on a more or less full-time basis? And I said, at the time, the computer game company, I was having that spider sense tingling. For those of you at home, I made a little spider sense wiggle on the back of my neck to show that something is up. And I knew that things were not going to go well at the MMO company because they had just gotten a new owner that was trying to do a bunch of, I would say, sort of shady stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I worked it out with the Chaosium people. I worked it out with the company where I got a nice severance and a wonderful exit parachute. And then I pretty much, like, I think I took 2 days off, and then I immediately started working full time with Chaosium and also working on the Modiphius Conan game, which I was had done uninterrupted. And so it was a very easy transition. Now, I did a few consulting bits here and there for some computer game companies in the first year or two, but ultimately, I don't know, I really prefer the tabletop stuff.
We had the imagery of you arriving in Austin with a backpack full of gaming experience from the tabletop, and then how that spread and influenced your work digitally. Now we're in Germany. Your backpack is full of all of that time working on MMOs, and from a technical standpoint, from a creative standpoint, you now come back to creating in the tabletop industry. What was new? So how did working in that digital world change how you approached tabletop?
Well, process was one of the biggest things I had learned, because when you're dealing with computer game companies, it's you're dealing at an entirely different level of production. Yeah. You're communicating with multiple organizations within a company, different departments. And, you know, so, for example, without my computer game experience, I don't think I could have ever been a line manager. Right. The notion of, but as a lead designer in MMOs, I was accustomed to dealing with both QA issues, system design, narrative design, programming, writing system specs, and all of that. And so I think that the biggest takeaway I got from that was both the discipline of trying to figure out production pipelines and how things go from, you know, taking something from just the most rudimentary idea into something that is coming back from China on a boat, in a printed version. And so I think that's really the biggest takeaway I got there. But also sort of learning to stress test mechanics. MMO mechanics, they need to be tested on servers. You know, if somebody does something that the rules don't accommodate, you crash the server frequently. Or, you know, you can end up like corrupting a character or a database. There are so many things I've seen over the years, you know, where people discovered, oh, if I do this and I hit this character combination and slash and boom, then the server goes down and you're getting a call at, you know, 2 a.m. on a Saturday night to come in so that they can do a hot fix. And you have to like edit and add that particular combination to the prohibited words list as a hacky solution to that, just so people can't type that in, you know.
Isn't
so yeah, and I mean, that was the kind of thing that I learned was, you know, RPGs have a lot more tolerance, with the game master being ultimately the one who can decide, oh well, that rule is stupid, I'm just gonna gloss over that, or oh, that puts me in a catch 22, let's just figure out how to go past that. And so so yeah, I think that MMO development is a absolute boot camp for what I do now. It really helped out considerably.
So something you've hinted at a few times, Jason, and I find this fascinating, because this conversation is very different. When I talk to players about game balance, it's different than when I talk to designers about game balance. And, you know, obviously within the constraints of MMOs, you know, there, that's even another conversation, right? Game balance. Where, strictly in the tabletop realm, how much importance do you put on that concept of game balance, where all characters are created equal and things like that? And this of course harkens all the way back to your Stormbringer days, right?
I personally, I think that I have a very, there's an obvious sense of, oh, that's a bit unbalanced. But I think that the idea of perfectly balanced games is both, it's an elusive, it's like the questing beast. You may never find it, and it could drive you mad seeking it. And also, to be frank, the types of games that require that level of like precise balancing of attack speed and, you know, the equivalent of the DPS and whatnot, mana regeneration, power cycling speed and all that, that level of approximation in a game, I find just uninteresting. I'm
not
saying,
a game you'd want to play.
Not really, no. Yeah. And I try to play a lot of games. I play very technical, very crunchy games, and I play very woo-woo storytelling games where, you know, everything is just a negotiation. I think it's important to keep testing my tastes and doing that. But I find that like game balance is it's entirely sort of mythical. Yeah. You know, and in the basic role-playing book, I think I even addressed it at one point where I said, you know, like you can decide, like all the characters will have the same number of points and they'll have exactly the same decisions they make. And let's say you come up with a game where you're all playing members of a crime family. And then one of the players is a undercover detective. You've just created a vast imbalance in the game that is entirely narrative.
Right.
And it ultimately will shape every scene. And that's, you know, that kind of stuff. And, you know, if you can give a unimaginative character or an unimaginative player a really powerful character, and if they don't know how to do that, you know, to manage that character, then you've got an imbalance.
Right.
Amber Diceless Roleplaying was excellent in pointing out that a creative and enterprising character with fewer points built on a much lower budget can run rings around much more experienced and much more powerful characters. And so that was pretty emblematic for my my experience of towards game balance and whatnot. I mean, I can look at a table of weapons and I can shave off a number here and try to decide if, you know, 2d4 plus 2, would it be better to make that 1d8 plus 1? You know, right. These kinds of very minute changes and understand how dice steps work and whatnot. But ultimately, I don't have a lot of interest in trying to create this sort of artificial balance.
Yeah, I can tell you, as somebody who also plays a lot of miniature games, obviously that's completely another conversation. And and I don't remember who said it, and I feel bad if I'm quoting you as a previous guest, but one of the things that struck me the most was, you know, when you think about the most interesting memories you have playing role-playing games, they were also likely one of the most imbalanced moments in that time. And I was like, holy crap, that's exactly right.
Oh, absolutely. That sounds like a thing that John Wick would say. So
it may have been John. He's been on the show.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, they're the things where you rolled the crazy critical in, right. You know, like you sat down to roll and you're like, all I need to do is get below an 85 on this D100 and everything will be okay. And boom, double zero. Oh, you know, everyone groans, but you've just created this amazing
moment
or, yeah, you know, the unexpected critical hit that changes the tide of a battle in mid. I mean, even during our RuneQuest playtests, a couple of years ago before the pandemic, one of the last face to face times our group met. But in the middle of a fairly routine fight with some fairly unimpressive dark trolls, our badass warrior maiden, Vasana, she took a critical to the chest while she was charging a troll with her on her bison with her lance, and just punctured armor, took her down out of the fight instantly, and the rest of us were like, oh no. And suddenly the tide turned there, and it became a scramble to try to recover from that that major upset. And I think that's the kind of stuff that people remember more than, boy, that was a well-balanced fight.
2-hour combat.
Yeah, that fight ground on for exactly as long as it seemed to need to go. And, you know, everybody did a fairly reasonable amount of damage each turn until that's not the stuff people remember. They like to remember the crazy, like, you know, the roles that kind of just shift things dramatically.
Yeah, the crash the server, right?
Right. Well,
so, guys, we're going to take a break. When we get back from this break, it's a game that Jason has been a part of that I am fascinated from a fluff perspective as well as a mechanic perspective. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to talk about the 2D20 system for Conan. We'll be right back.
This is the part of many podcasts where someone comes on, interrupts the show, and explains that you should consider paying for the content that you're listening to right now for free. That pitch man explains by giving a dollar or more a month, you not only support the show, but you allow the show to grow and improve. Here on the third floor, we refuse to interrupt your episode of Tabletop Talk with such time-wasting pleas. We pledge never to run a spot, asking you to go to patreon.com and give a dollar or more a month, because supporting content creators keeps the content coming. Even if there is a link in the show's description, and there is, we don't ask you to click it and become a patron. We don't waste time rambling about the benefits like early access to episodes, getting episodes without ad breaks like this, or even getting a chance to play in one of Craig's RPG sessions. Anyway, enjoy this episode knowing Tabletop Talk, despite being supported by its patrons, won't engage in such blatant appeals for support.
So my listeners know this, Jason, but I don't know if I've talked to you about it. I took a 23-year break from role playing. Not a conscious one. It just kind of happened, right? And I still geeked out that time, played miniature games and things like that. But about 2 years ago, I came back to role playing. And as you might imagine, a lot happened in those two decades. I was amazed. And there's been a lot of companies that have put out stuff that didn't exist when I had left, and a lot of systems that were in place that I had no concept of. And one of the ones that caught me initially was the Conan 2D20 for a couple of reasons. One, it's Conan. I'm a fan from as a kid. I was like you. I read it as a kid, probably too young.
That was when my I experience as well. Far too young.
And then the mechanics of it were maybe not new to people that it didn't take the break, but for me, kind of like blew my mind a little bit when I first came across 2D20. So for those that are listening, can we give just a quick overview and an understanding of that system?
Well, it's the 2D20 system. Ultimately, when you try to perform any action, you roll 2D20 against a target number that is based on a combination of stat plus skill. There are a number of talents that you can have that can add extra dice to that or extra bonuses to that number or give you a reroll or something like that. And then the system has these kind of unique meta currencies called momentum and doom. These have different names in some of the different 2D20 games. But for Conan, momentum was just it sort of ties into a line from one of the sorcerers who's talking about success breeds success. And so the idea with momentum is when you get extra successes with a roll, because you're rolling two dice and one success is usually enough to do something. But if you get two and you can roll up to five dice, mm-hmm. for anything. So, you know, if you manage to stack all of your different talents and conditions, you can be rolling a little mini fistful of dice. And you can take the extra successes and use those as momentum. And there's a pool of momentum that everyone in the group can draw from. And so that lets you do some other various things, like it might let you key special effects or pick up to roll extra dice or do various other cool things with the system. The meanwhile, the Game Master has a system called Doom, which is another point, a little horde full of like anti-drama tokens, if you will. They're like cruel fate tokens. And they can spend those to power NPC stuff, to introduce complications and to basically sort of like activate conditions or environmental concerns or bring in new encounter, like a guard captain can suddenly summon two new guards for two doom. I'm just pulling that number out of my thin air. Please don't check me there. And so basically what it does is it, now, again, I say that I'm skeptical about the notion of perfect balance, but it gives the Game Master a budget for what mm-hmm. they can do in a session, and also creates a sort of collaborative effort where players should understand that the Game Master is not their enemy, that right. they are, in fact, trying to, it's like they're making a movie and this is how much money I have. So here's where I'm going to bring in the big CGI monster. But that means that for the two scenes prior, we're just going to have normal looking humans fighting you.
Right.
And so it sort of creates this idea that there's this sort of ebb and tide of, or ebb and flow of, action in the game. Like there will be quiet periods where the characters aren't earning a lot of momentum, and then the players can decide to take Doom. And basically what they do is they tell the game master, hey, I'm going to take an extra dice here because I really want to succeed. And the game master is like, hey, now I have a Doom token. And then, you know, there you go. And then there's the game gets a lot more granular than that, but that's ultimately like the high level of how it all works. I mean, players also have fortune points, which they have a few of, which are like super momentum points, basically. Right. And they have a few other cool features, like, you know, you can buy off all kinds of cool things or get insta successes. And, you know, it's funny, too, because, I mean, the whole idea of the Doom thing was I was first to expose that to in the Marvel Saga role playing game where you had five suits and of cards, and one of them was Doom. And so you drew cards based on how powerful a character you were. You had a different hand size. And if you played a Doom card to make up the points to succeed in your task you were doing, the game master kept the Doom card and then could use it against you. And when we played Doom, this was with a different group of people. This is actually after I came back from Japan and I was hanging around with a very eclectic Seattle gaming group. Our game master literally had a Dr. Doom coffee mug of like Doom's head, and that was the Doom bank. And so whenever you played a Doom card,
that's amazing.
The GM would put those in, and then at the, you know, you were always very careful as players, and sometimes you've just got a handful of crap because you're like, oh no, I've got Doom cards, and if I spend a Doom card to succeed now, I'm giving this is going to be the GM's screw me card later in the game. And so it was, you know, pretty funny overall to watch that mechanic where people were just like, I'm not going to do anything. And I was like, oh, you got a handful of Doom. Yeah. And so, you know, because you didn't want to give the GM any points, and the GM, the mechanics say the GM needs to spend all the Doom by the end of the session. So this is where you end up with the bad guy is just, you know, having his inevitable comeback or surprise counterattack devastating the heroes at a certain point.
Yeah.
And you know, the dull end encounters were the ones where the players managed to just starve the GM of any Doom. But the cool ones were when the GM just had a fistful of Doom and was ready to use it. And so like to me that was a very natural thing for Conan, especially. Yeah. I remember having a bizarre argument with a bunch of interesting people on a website that I will not mention by name. And they were like, oh, this Doom mechanic has no place in Conan. There's nothing about Conan that indicates there's this malignant force that is sort of present. I said, oh, well, here's a quote from Conan where he says, don't gain the attention of Crom because Crom will send dooms against you. And I said, is a quote from Robert E. Howard using the word doom and describing the game mechanic, is that enough to convince you? And, you know, crickets chirping after that.
I like people, obviously, because this is audio, but Jason can see my face. Like, you started to tell me that. And I'm like, had they read Conan?
No. I mean, or they've read some particular absurd. Maybe they just didn't understand it.
Yeah. I mean, part of what one of the many things that I love about Howard's work was the concept of Crom, right? Yes. And this concept of it's a god that was not benevolent
to worship. No, he's a god you try to avoid thinking about.
It's really that's amazing. Yeah. So, Jason, where did you come in contact with this at first, right? So, was it at the very beginning? Had work been done? Like, where did you get into the sphere of this game?
Ground zero. Was working on, well, because I had worked with on Chaos, it's like weird how these things just sort of chain. Because I had worked on basic role playing, there was a point where I was contacted by Chris Birch at Modiphius, and they had just picked up the license for Mutant Chronicles. And they were wondering if they wanted to do a BRP adaptation of that instead of their 2D20 system, because 2D20 didn't really exist at that time. And so Chris asked me if I would be the sort of like father of that. And at the time, I just didn't have the time. We were shipping an MMO. I was too busy. But I said, I tell you what I'm going to do. You call me a consultant. I'm happy to like answer emails and questions. And I wrote basically sort of a 5 or 6 page, like, here's how you would turn Mutant Chronicles into a basic role-playing game. And he looked at that and he was like, okay. And then I think for various reasons, they decided they wanted to come up with their own system. I think Chris is really into the notion of having a house system for Modiphius, and which is great. So he then said, okay, well, we're going to go with this new system, 2D20. And then there was some reason he asked me about a Cthulhu thing. And I said, yeah, I love Cthulhu. And he said, would you like to write something for Octone Cthulhu? And I said, sure. And so we had a very long conversation about that, where my first work with them was taking pieces of manuscripts that a whole bunch of other authors had written for the Assault on the Mountains of Madness. And I turned that into a, Chris described it as, oh, it's just basically like filling in spackle between these bricks that are already there. And I mean, it wasn't at all. There were massive sections missing. The tones were completely different between sections. You know, one writer had written his section all with like little canned text. The characters go into a thing. This is what you read out loud to them. Some people had nothing else. There was no recurring villain. There were no major characters involved. And there was no like through story.
Yeah.
So, and also, you know, the first thing was just, oh, and here the characters are at Antarctica. And I was like, well, how do they get there? And Chris said, oh, I had this idea for this barge made out of pycrete, which is this sort of frozen sawdust. And I said, well, how do we make that interesting? And so from then on, it just became, you know, what was basically like 6 or 7 pieces of chapters became this epic 300-page campaign.
Wow.
Where I had to write. And it had no ending as well, which was like, it just sort of described the ending city, you know, the city of the elder things as, and it was just there. And I was like, well, what are they trying to do? You know, how, okay, wow. They're trying to do something. I get what they're trying to do, but are there any NPCs? What's happening here? So I ended up writing all that. Wow. And I feel like I probably ran roughshod over the other authors, and I apologize to them. And if any of them present me with the grievance, I will happily buy them a round of drinks. But, you know, so that I did that. And then midway through, Chris asked me, he said, you know, I can't say for sure, but do you have any interest in Conan? And I was like, I have been interested in Conan since I was a wee boy.
Yeah.
Like literally from, I think I hit Conan from watching the Tarzan TV series with Ron Eli to reading the Edgar Rice Burroughs book, and then just working my way down the library shelf, and it went Burroughs, and then I found a Lynn Carter Conan. I know. But anyway, I was like, fortunately for me, Carter followed Burroughs quite closely, right. And I pick it up and there's a savage looking black haired guy holding a knife fighting something on the cover. And I'm like, all right. This looks like the same kind of stuff. And then I like, wow. And so, then when the project came together, I was involved at the very earliest stages. Originally, there was a different line editor who was unable to continue because I don't think he was really ready for that. And then there was another line editor after that who I just didn't work out. And then on my birthday, Chris called me up. He didn't know it was my birthday, but he called me up and asked me if I was willing to take on the line. And I said, sure. And that led to 7 years of, not 7 years, I think all in all about 5 years total from the prep up to the Kickstarter. And then the 4 years after the Kickstarter, releasing 20 some books,
it's amazing.
Just so much stuff. And I mean, I know that many of the Kickstarter backers feel like it took forever, but work was done. I mean, I can't think of days where I didn't do something related to that game. And the fact that I have literally half a bookshelf full of that is, I'm not even sure that any other game has ever released so much content in such a short time.
It's pretty crazy. And we had Lynn Hardy on, and you know, the one thing that she was talking about with Achtung, similar, you know, it took some time, right, to get all of Achtung out there. And she made a comment, and Chris has been on the show, but she made a comment, you know, that Chris is like, you know, it's going to come out when it's ready, and it's, and if it's not ready, then it's not coming out. Did you encounter that, with Conan as well? Or was there a lot of things in play that created that?
There's a word in Germany that's sort of a combination of the word ja, which is yes, and nein, which is no, and it's ja ein, where I would say that yes, it very initially it was very much a case of yes, the books are going to take some time, let's get them done.
Yeah.
But of course, as things go on, you know, you've got, I mean, we broke up the shipping into three different shipments. And that just, you end up with just a nonstop chorus of Kickstarter backers who are feeling angry, and
yeah,
they feel betrayed because of the way the Kickstarter was broken up. We allowed people to pick when the books were shipped, and many of the more hardcore backers shipped all at once, mm-hmm. and which meant that not a single book wasn't going out into them until all the books were done.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, I would have loved if we had, so we were releasing PDFs all the time, but I think people really wanted their physical copies. And yeah. So I think there was it started out a little more relaxed in terms of, well, we're going to get the books done. And then after each wave, there was a little bit of breathing room, but there was an ongoing concern pressure. And a pressure to get it out. And at no point did I feel like we just had the luxury of time. I mean, I've always viewed, even though Modiphius is fiscally secure and mm-hmm. Doing quite well and firing on all fronts, I mean, there's a certain issue where you do a Kickstarter that makes a lot of money, yep. and you have this pile of money, and then a timer happens, and it's exactly. like an hourglass, and sand is yep. just dropping out all the time, and your goal is to get to the end of the process before the final grains of sand have fallen out of that, and sometimes,
and nobody's, you know, pouring sand at the top, right?
It's no. I mean, now that seems to be something that people do, which I find amazing, that people yeah. are, you know, they'll do a project on Kickstarter and then they'll go to Game on Tabletop and do a second round of funding or whatnot. But that wasn't really an option for Conan. And you know, the project takes time. I think that we approached it with a level of dedication and craft that is pretty solid. But the other thing too is that recruiting for people to write Conan is really specific. I mean, it requires a certain tone and yeah. a certain knowledge of that world that most you can't just pick up and run with.
That's
you really need
yeah.
to be sort of immersed in that setting. And so I found a lot of recruiting for the game was really challenging.
I would imagine you could smell the inauthenticity real quick, right?
Oh, absolutely.
If you had the right, yes. wrong person.
I mean, there was a point where we did an open call for adventure pitches, and I think, you know, 7 out of 8 were rejected. Just
yeah.
like, nope, not in tone. And, you know, I wrote an essay in the book called How to Write Adventures the Robert E. Howard Way, which I think is a pretty solid piece of advice, at least for giving. I mean, you would think that it would say, hey, this is what we're looking for. And, you know, when I would get into arguments with these writers about some of the adventures, I was like, I don't understand why this is happening. Generally,
yeah.
Conan stories, there's always a clear and coherent narrative. Things don't just happen.
Yeah.
And so so it was a little challenging there. But overall, it was a great experience.
At that point, Jason, was that the biggest thing that you had been responsible for?
Yeah. I mean, the basic role-playing rule book was, you know, this massive, nearly 400 page or something like that, like 380 or so, giant condensed version of all of the different basic role-playing system variants with all these optional rules. And yet the idea was you could take that book and then run pretty much any campaign of any sort
right.
you wanted to. You could just cobble it together. And that thing took 2.5 years. I ran a big play test with about 150 people, many of whom are now good, close friends. And,
that's
you know,
good.
I mean, like Sarah Newton, her first game development, she popped up and said, hey, I'd love to be a part of this BRP. playtest, and I said, I would love any help I can get. And so she was one of the just most amazing contributors to that. And yeah, I mean, that had been the largest up to then. And then, you know, the Conan core book was bigger than basic role playing. And then the following 19 books plus maps plus those. And I mean, I'm still working indirectly on Conan stuff. So, you know, all of these various bits and pieces, I'm just looking down on their geometric tile sets and the GM pack and all of that kind of
stuff. It's amazing.
So much, much stuff.
Yeah. And it's not to blow smoke, but it's pretty damn good, Jason.
Well, thanks.
I mean, yeah, it's really, really good. And one of the things that I like about the 2D20 system and what Mr. Birch is doing with it is I love how similar to what Free League does with the Year Zero, right? It's not the same in every one of their games,
right?
But it's familiar, but it's adapted. So 2D20 in Star Trek is not the same as 2D20 in Conan, but it fits. And they've done a real brilliant job with that, I think.
And I mean, if we were to design a second edition of Conan, we might approach it with, you know, we might do some things differently based on what we've learned.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely no question. So, guys, we're going to take one last break. When we get back from that break, we're going to get to modern day. We've been talking about everything leading up here. I'm going to talk to Jason about what exactly a creative director at Chaosium does. And then, more importantly, I want to spend time talking about RuneQuest. We'll be right back. Hey, it's me. I'm interrupting this episode. And I hope you're enjoying it, and I bet you're anxious to hear the rest. But before we jump back, I need a favor. Do you know someone who might enjoy this episode? Can you shoot them a quick message or maybe even send them a link to it? Listeners sharing this podcast was the primary reason we almost doubled our audience last year. Also, would you like to see and hear these games in action? Go to the Third Floor Wars YouTube channel and Twitch stream. Our actual plays combine compelling role-playing, character-driven action, and system tutorials. We create great stories while lifting the hood and showcasing the game mechanics. Links to both are in the show notes. Okay, last thing, and I mean it. Have you rated this podcast on your pod platform yet? Maybe even written a short review? It is a simple way for you to be even more awesome than you already are. Okay, now I'm done. Let's jump back and listen to the rest of this episode. So creative director for RuneQuest and BRP is an impressive title, Jason. I assume when you wake up in the morning, there's horns that go off and confetti that comes down. But in reality, what exactly does that mean? So when you wake up in the morning and start work for the day, what does that even look like?
Well, I live in a busy city street in Berlin, and so, yes, there are horns in the morning. It's usually just a big garbage truck and people honking, "Get out of the way, garbage truck."
Oh, that's funny.
So, yeah, I'm usually up pretty early. I don't know. I mean, at a certain point, I think I'm creative director of BRP stuff, and RuneQuest ultimately is Jeff Richards's baby. I mean, he is the master, the con, the grand poobah of Glorantha. And so my primary focus with that is getting books done, you know, contributing to coordinating writers, shotgunning to make sure that everybody gets their stuff done, and bringing the books all together so that everything happens. Jeff is the division is Jeff is more the creative side and I'm more the director.
Got it.
And so if that makes sense,
It
has anything to do with Glorantha as a whole, then that's really Jeff's call. He's been living in that world for far longer and far deeper than I have. And so I frequently have to defer to him with questions of, hey, does this make sense to you? Is this something you would see in Glorantha? Is this, you know, or is this a little more Bronze Age or a little too advanced? And so so Jeff does that. But basically every morning I spend, you know, a couple of hours just going through emails, looking at art, sending out art briefs, reviewing contracts, replying to emails on all of the various projects. And then a lot of actual copy editing. I try to get
you know, a proofreader and a copy editor for each project, but there are certain projects that I feel that I need to be the one who does that. And so there's a large portion of my day is spent actually just reviewing text, going over stuff. And I'm one of these people, because I have my desktop publishing background, I can open up InDesign and make corrections to the actual files and, you know, in some cases, even rough stuff out for our layout people to, or, you know, draw extraordinarily primitive maps and send them. This is a secret, but I try to make my maps and my mockups as primitive as possible, because I want to make sure that, you know, the creative personnel feel like they can contribute something, but also so that they don't get influenced by,
right,
you know, they don't look at that and they go, oh, he wants something that looks mostly like that. Whereas if I draw something clearly crude and primitive, they go, okay, I can, as they say in Germany, put my mustard on that, meaning to, you know, I can add myself into this project. And so I want people to feel that they are creatively invested in the work that they do, rather than just sort of, you know, a tool that the creative powers that be use to get things done.
That makes sense. Now, Jeff's on my hit list, and I hope to have Jeff on the show at some point. But really, your perspective, Jason, is kind of interesting to me right now for RuneQuest, because your hands are all over it, right? So you're touching a lot of things. You're seeing things getting made. You're putting things together and stuff. But there's a little bit of an outsider, right? If Jeff is really, you know, on top of the creative piece of it, the mystery for me with RuneQuest, because this RuneQuest was not part of my journey as a role player.
Okay.
But like Pendragon, it keeps coming up. So as I'm talking to creatives and I'm talking to designers, somehow RuneQuest keeps coming up. RuneQuest. And I'd be curious, Jason, if you have a sense, in the same way that you did a great job with Pendragon, what is it about RuneQuest that so many designers say that was a part of me? That was a part of who I became.
Well, in many ways, it is the strengths of RuneQuest are similar to the strengths of Pendragon, in that they are both the both collaborative works, but also they are driven by the creative. I mean, I would say Greg Stafford is a creative genius, or was a creative genius. He is. I think arguably he was one of the finest creative minds in game development thus far. And it is humbling to work, you know, on projects that he created. And, you know, as John Wick is fond of saying, anytime you think you came up with a really cool idea or a mechanic, Greg Stafford probably came up with it 25 years ago and
said that
it's
exact
there
quote.
Somewhere. Yeah. and so, and RuneQuest, in some ways, like I said, it sort of has this weird combination, this gestalt of Steve Perrin's very simulationist mechanics, with strike ranks, with basic, you know, with sort of like taking your stats and figuring your skill category bonuses and hit points per location, this real gritty, visceral combat mechanic where, you know, you're feeling like I could die at any moment.
Yeah.
And then marrying that to this kind of crazy Bronze Age mythological trippy setting where there are intelligent baboons and elves grow from trees and dwarves are part of a world machine, you know, and eat canned food and, you know, I mean, just this just completely trippy stuff that, is like unlike anything else you've seen in, or anyone had seen in games. And that was, I think, the real liberation that RuneQuest did. For as much as Pendragon was on point in evoking that that sense of, you know, chivalric Arthurian both behavior and combat and adventure, RuneQuest was in like just completely this sort of the sky is the limit in what you can do in this world. You know, there are all kinds of crazy things, the gods and the cults. I mean, that was something that, you know, you'd never really seen. I mean, when you created a character in D&D, you picked a god. Maybe you had stats for them, so if you could fight them. And you kind of knew their alignment and some stuff, but, and maybe there was some special thing about that god, but but there wasn't a lot more than that. But this whole idea about like your character starting out as being a member of this cult that is influential throughout the world, and everyone being part of a cult, everyone using magic. And you know, like I say, a phrase I have used probably far too many times, as I say the thing about RuneQuest, is the characters have their feet in the mud and their head in the heavens.
Yeah.
You know, they're literally getting into fights where any, you know, like just a little trollkin can use a sling stone and kill the mightiest of characters in one blow if they manage to roll a critical and hit them in the head or whatnot.
Right.
And yet at the same time, these characters have these, like, you know, they're kind of on these crazy hero quests, trippy journeys into other alternate realities. And, you know, the gods themselves are manifesting in them when they use their runic powers. And so I think that which just like, wow. I mean, you can't, I mean, if you look at chivalry and sorcery, even Dragon Quest, Dungeons and Dragons, the fantasy trip, Tunnels and Trolls, and you put them all in a row and then you set RuneQuest next to them, it's pretty obvious that RuneQuest is just a completely different thing.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, just, you know, it's something that's trying for something far grander and far
that's
more
cool.
Far more epic than and that is not to give any of those other games any slight or throw shade on them.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
To just say that it's clear that the ambitions of RuneQuest were creatively, I think, energizing.
Yeah. Yeah, that helps a lot considerably. So let's talk about BRP just for a little bit, Jason, because here your hands are a lot dirtier, right? You're a lot more involved in that.
Blood up to my elbows.
Yeah. So, you know, for me, the world that I left 20 years ago, it was the Hero System Champions GURPS. And mm-hmm. that's really where role playing was pushing more towards that. And then, of course, you have Savage Worlds, another universal type system. When you're presented with BRP, where do you find space for that as another universal system? What makes BRP so loved? I mean, that's the one thing I can say about that is you ask somebody about BRP and you never get nobody ever says it's okay. It's either I've never looked at it or, oh my God, this game is amazing.
Or they hate it.
And I haven't talked to the haters yet.
Oh, okay, they exist.
I'm sure they do. I'm sure they let you know.
Oh, absolutely.
In your mind, like, so where does BRP fit in that universal ecosystem?
Well, I think that ultimately, like, BRP is the ultimate toolkit game yeah. because the sheer the resolution mechanic of the D100, the flat distribution system, it is transparent. I mean, it is incredibly easy to see what happens when you add something onto it. And I would say as a chassis, it's got hard points all over it that you could just bolt all kinds of crap on to get into a sort of try to stretch that metaphor a little farther.
Yeah.
Like you can just decide, you can dial it up. You can double hit points. You can have hit points per location. You can add superpowers to it. You can add psychic powers. You can add mutations. I mean, you could take them away. You could run it in a pulp milieu with very few tweaks. And I think that ultimately is very appealing for people who like to sort of kitbash a little bit. And I think what I would say is just the genius about the mechanic is that it's incredibly intuitive. Mm. I mean, I do understand quite a bit about statistics, and sometimes I have to break them down to people and, you know, tell. But for example, many people don't understand how bell curve works. And, you know, so when you're rolling 2d6 and adding something and subtracting something, or you're rolling a dice pool, mm-hmm. those numbers are not always obvious. You know, if anything, I would think that, I mean, if I would say one of the things I find sometimes challenging about working with 2d20, for example,
right.
is that probability success is not always evident because...
Yep.
You know, we've got some tables in the background where I can sort of look and say, okay, if you're rolling 4d6 at this number, this is your chance. And what our 4D20 at this number. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I think BRP is just it just pulls the curtain aside and shows you the engine, and you can sort of look at it and you can add on your stuff. You can pull stuff away. You can decide to run RuneQuest combat. I mean, you could take the core rule book and then just decide, oh, I'm going to just do without strike ranks. Everybody gets one attack per round.
Yeah.
You know, and the game runs. I mean, it, you might need to make some little adjustments on the fly, but it runs. And yeah. I think that that is really a testament to how solid it is. And that I think is, like I say, both the marriage of Glorantha with RuneQuest is exciting. And we haven't really talked about Call of Cthulhu, but I think in that's another one of these weird, perfect pairings of system and mechanics, because, you know, this is both Greg and Sandy working on this, but I think that Lovecraft's cold scientific universe, which is basically a science fiction horror universe, mm-hmm. the flat mechanical, the pitiless mechanic of D100
yeah.
is perfect for feeling like you're alone in a vast and uncaring universe, like
interesting
the mythos.
Yeah.
You know? And so that is, I think, you know, one of the, I think there's a gestalt where people yeah. who like RuneQuest also like Call of Cthulhu, who also like Pendragon, and all of these games kind of, they sort of stick together, and you have the warm fuzzies. I mean, would I love Stormbringer as much if I didn't have those other three or four or five games, you know,
right.
floating around in the back burner? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. So as I would imagine, you're in the running for playing the most games of BRP, or at least being a part of the most games.
Who knows?
Yeah. But, so what I would be interested in as we wrap up, Jason, is there certain settings or moments that you can think of within playing within the ecosystem of BRP that really stick out? Some favorites of you. It doesn't make it better or worse in the greater sense, but for Jason, where do you really love to play BRP?
I'm having just a hellaciously fun time with the Lords of the Middle Sea game that we're playtesting right now, where the characters are basically, they are the crew of an airship, a semi-rigid dirigible flying around over a sunken North America in the year 26 something. It's a little vague. And you know, it's got a little bit of, a canticle for Leibowitz, a little bit of Mad Max, a little bit of, this future where a little bit of Serenity, you know, where there's both this upbeat, like things are changing, but at the same time you have all these warlords striving for power in this political game, and the players are just basically trying to get paid and enjoy life. And that has been an absolute joy to run. The playtest actually began as the pandemic kicked in.
Wow.
And so I have never to this day actually played a tabletop version of it. It's only been entirely virtual. And all the playtesting has been online with various groups. I've done some demos and some secret little one-shots and playtested some things. And then we've got the house campaign, which is, I'm going to be playing in like 3 hours.
Fun.
That has been epic. Stormbringer also, just the sheer craziness. I mean, once you start figuring out demon summoning in Stormbringer, everything goes nuts. And early RuneQuest experiences playing, I wasn't the game master of it, but, you know, just playing a group of hardscrabble just people trying to get by, living on the edges of Pavis, going into the rubble periodically to see what we could get, was just tremendous fun. And so those are the kinds of things I really enjoyed. I wish we had gotten to play more ElfQuest and Ringworld, but for various just life reasons, those games didn't really stick the way that others did. But I think those are amazing. And then, you know, every so often I'll just dust off one of these older games and run it. There's a semi-local convention here in Germany called the Kraken. And the last time we had a face-to-face that I was at it was 2 years ago, and I ran a game of Elric, which was it was basically shamelessly ripping off Escape from New York.
And, you know, Robin Laws was one of my players, and he just went berserk. Kidding. It was quite fun. and so, you know, it was one of those where just everything went a little nuts. And
Oh, that's fun.
And so, yeah, I I think that the combination of rules and setting really are epic. And I have this weird habit where about once every Kraken, I come up with a couple of games that are just one shots that are just some crazily influenced. I run them almost entirely free form in that I don't generally have a rough outline of what I'm going to do. Right. All of the work is spent just making character sheets. And I use the big gold book as the guideline. I did one that was like a sort of Mesopotamian science fiction game, sort of shamelessly ripping off Lord of Light. I've done a crazy post-apocalyptic weird universe game that, was a little gamma worldy, but a little more epic than that. I've done a big space opera style thing. And every year I find that it's just a lot of fun to just bring BRP in and just take it for its run, you know, for a sprint or a course around the track, so to speak.
Now, the last thing I'll ask, and I ask this of all my guests, and sometimes the answer is, Craig, I don't have time. Is there anything out there that you're not involved with, that you didn't have your fingers in, that you're enjoying or excited about? And that could be another role-playing system, another role-playing setting. It could be a board game, video games. I'd be curious, when Jason is not doing your job, is there stuff where that right now that you're just excited about and really enjoying?
Oh, absolutely. The campaign that I'm running with my local friends, we've just gotten into the face-to-face meetups in the past month and a half since Germany has sort of relaxed its restrictions on social gatherings. We meet at a beer garden every other Sunday afternoon, and we've been playing. Yeah, I know. We've been playing Spire, which is really fun.
And they've been on the show too. It's a crazy game.
The system works for everybody. It's very light. It's very fun. Yep. And I have no connection whatsoever with anyone other than giving them money to give me awesome game books. I just picked up Heart, and we'll probably do a delve into the Heart below the Spire at some point. I have a shelf that is probably about 2.5 feet of Free Elegant stuff. I mean, the whole Mutant Year Zero universe. I love those. I ran a Coriolis campaign for, I think we got about 28 sessions or so into that. We did a bunch of solo, starting adventures. And then we did the first of the Emissary Lost campaign. And, then that we just wrap that up, and we're taking a breather for a while. We may go back to it. Depends on how the players feel. And then I loved running Vaosen, which has been an absolute delight. One of my favorite pickup games I discovered online was Barbarians of Lemuria, just because it's so simple. It's like a barbaric crunch, but very little in the way of crunchy mechanics. And so, it was a lot of fun to run, and I find that when I'm running stuff online, I tend to go for a simpler mechanical set. I'm just looking at my games now to see, you know, obviously we could spend a lot of hours. But another game that I have no involvement with whatsoever, but I love quite dearly, is, I shouldn't say game, is Tecumel. I've been a fan of Tecumel ever since the hearing about it back in Dragon Magazine in the 70s, you know, the late 70s.
Not familiar with it.
Oh, wow. Tecumel was like, I'm not sure if it was the second or the third D&D setting. It is alternate. So it dates back to like 75 or so. It was already in existence before there was D&D as a setting that this this linguist, Professor M.A.R. Barker, came up with. It is a
weird fantasy science fiction hybrid set in a sort of a vast science fiction-y world, but has resorted to mostly almost Mesoamerican culture with this sort of highly Baroque Byzantine social structure that there are languages. It's epic. It's there have been at least six or seven Tecumel games, Empire of the Petal Throne, and a bunch of others like this. And I think Guardians of Order probably did what I would consider to be the best Tecumel game, but my knowledge, but that was a one and done kind of a thing. They were unable to continue the line. I don't think that in my mind there's been a really great Tecumel game. But the setting is amazing. I mean, there's the certain sweet spot is science fantasy for me. Like if it's science fantasy, I'm instantly excited about it, you know, whether it be Tecumel or Jorun or Tales from Gargantir or any of these weird John Carter, Warlord of Mars is technically just science fiction pulp. But it sort of has that same sort of a feeling. So
well, there's a huge fantasy piece to Carter. There's no question.
Right. Yeah. So, but yeah, that is really my my sweet spot. And so,
nice.
Of all of them, I have zero involvement with Tecumel, and yet I have a shelf full of Tecumel. And
that's awesome.
You know, if Chaosium ever decided that they would love to do Chaos, every so often I kind of test the waters. I'm like, maybe we should talk to the Tecumel people, and no. We're already too busy.
Yeah, boy, that's the truth. The stuff that is coming out of that building is unbelievable.
There is no building though. We are a completely virtual company.
I don't think I realized that. No kidding.
No. Until Jeff. Jeff just moved from Berlin a month ago, or even less than a month ago, a few weeks ago, and I think, as far as I know, he and I were the only two Chaosium employees to live in the same city.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, and I only met him after I moved here. You know, I had no idea who he was other than I knew him by name, but that was it, and didn't know he lived in Berlin or anything like that until one of my basic role-playing playtesters put us in touch with each other. But yeah, I don't think Mike... The Call of Cthulhu crowd is mostly in England, and I don't think any two Chaosium employees live in the same city.
Amazing.
It's a little crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy, especially when you consider the amount of quality that still Chaosium is associated with and continues. That was true 25 years ago when I was role playing, and I was happy when I came back and just saw not only the quality was the same, but how many more games had fallen under the umbrella since I had been gone. Boy, Jason, can't thank you enough, my friend. This was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I had a great time chatting with you.
I'm glad. So if somebody wants to get more Jason, if they're listening right now, where's some places they can go?
You know, you could always hit me up on Facebook or whatnot. I don't really use Twitter that much, but you would go to either chaosium.com and poke around in the RuneQuest section. Join any of the RuneQuest groups on Facebook. I tend to participate in those quite a bit. I'm also doing work on the Dune RPG for Modiphius. And so I spend a little bit of my time doing that. And I need to do more, but there's only so much time in the day. and then I'm a member of several of the 2D20 Conan groups and whatnot. And so it's not hard to look me up or to find me. And I'm at jason@chaosium.com if anybody feels like dropping me a line to ask about, like, I want to write for you or whatnot. You know, hopefully I haven't said anything that terrifies people about the prospect of working with me.
No, you haven't. I've had Peterson on the phone. Okay. If anybody's going to terrify anybody, it's Sandy. Well, this is fantastic, Jason. At some point, I might have to trick you into coming on again. Sure. I really appreciate it. And you know who else I appreciate? I appreciate you for listening this long, the whole time. Thanks for listening. Take care.
episode, subscribe to Tabletop Talk and share it with your friends. Check out our content on YouTube and Twitch. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and stay updated on everything coming from Third Floor. All the links are in the show notes. Take care, floorheads.
Hey, are you still here? Wow. Well, the episode is over, but if you're bored, why not go to patreon.com and support the show for as little as $1 a month? Yeah, you can just scroll down and yeah, get the link. It's Patreon that makes this and all of our other content possible. Don't you want to join the other floorheads on the Patreon Discord? Anyway, thanks for sticking around. Take care.